Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page, and I would like to introduce my guest co-host, Dr. Amir Barzan, who is back with us again today. He's one of our fantastic chief resident physicians at UNC Family Medicine and is filling in for Adam today. Welcome back, Amir.
Thank you so much for having me again. I'm really looking forward to our show.
On our show today, Amir and I will be talking with Dr. Sarah Rosenquist, a psychotherapist and author, as well as Dr. Stephen Shaben, urologist at Associated Urologists of North Carolina, about sex, therapy, and marriage. We are talking about sex today.
Yeah, I think it's a topic that a lot of us have on our minds that we want to understand more, so the conversation should be really fruitful.
Yeah, we are looking forward to talking about sex. I wish we could put on that, let's talk about sex.
In the background.
Yeah, in the background, but we can't. Sorry. All right, moving on. We have some research that matters, and we're going to talk a little bit about measuring child doses of medicines.
We're also going to talk about dementia and widowhood.
And about a saliva test that might someday replace the needle prick for people with diabetes.
And then also about cigarette labeling and how much of a difference that has made in certain countries.
All right, so first let's talk about a spoonful of sugar. Does it help the medicine go down?
Well, according to the journal published in Pediatrics, there could be some measurements issues in children dosing their medications by their parents.
Yeah, so this is a study that was published in the journal Pediatrics, appropriately, where because there have been so many calls to poison centers based on wrong doses of like over-the-counter liquid medications or even prescribed by a physician liquid medications, they decided to sort of test if there's a difference in errors given to children based on whether the parents did it based on a teaspoon, instructions to say give a teaspoon or two teaspoons or a tablespoon versus giving it to them in the number of milliliters with a measuring device.
So in this study, 287 parents were provided medicine to their children, and they were observed to see if they dosed the medications according to the instructions. And surprisingly, 39% of parents incorrectly measured the dose when they were told to measure out in tablespoons and teaspoons as opposed to those who were told to measure out in milliliters.
And so I think this really puts a call to physicians and to parents to really think of dosing any liquid medications for children, encouraging us to do that in milliliters and to really be careful about measuring it out rather than just sort of kind of estimating based on a teaspoon measurement.
Absolutely. And in patients who are so small, like our children and our pediatric populations, just 1 or 2 milliliters more or less of a medication could over or underdose them. So it's really important to make sure we have that value right.
That's great. Okay, let's talk about dementia. So we know, and we've talked about many times on the show, Amir, that we know that we don't know all that much about dementia. What causes it? What are the factors? And so we're always trying as a research community and doctors and researchers trying to sort out what we can learn more about dementia so that we can work for a cure and prevention.
Absolutely. And one of the things that's really interesting is this discussion about losing a spouse in dementia. And surprisingly, out of the Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale, Arizona, a study was performed that looked if there was a link between losing a spouse and dementia, but the results may kind of surprise you.
Yeah, you would think that if you had some early memory problems and you lost a spouse and you're grieving over that, that that might make you more likely to get dementia or to progress more quickly to dementia. That's sort of what I would have guessed. But in fact, what they found was that there was a difference in brain functioning. So among the seniors who are starting to have some early memory problems, those who are widowed during the study period progressed to full-blown dementia about a decade later than the people who are still married. So something about that population and the experience of losing a spouse actually protected them from going on to dementia 10 years later in the study.
And it's very surprising because these are not small studies. They were done with approximately 3,800 married men and women in the first study and then almost more than 6,000 men and women in the second study. And to think that things like stress with spousal loss could accelerate dementia was actually disproven, which is kind of fascinating.
Yeah, and they sort of hypothesized maybe it's the social support. Like when someone loses a spouse, people really rally behind you and they come and visit you more. Or, you know, I wonder if there's something about having a new chapter in life and sort of having to start fresh with a different experience. Although you're grieving over having lost your spouse, it's a different chapter in life. Maybe there's something about that. But we certainly want to understand this more fully. And I mean, it's sort of good news in the midst of your loss that there might be a silver lining.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, another thing that will maybe hopefully lead to other discussions about dementia and where we're going in the future.
All right, let's talk about a spit test, a saliva test.
With the growing number of patients that are diabetic these days, one of the most important things is diagnosing diabetes appropriately and accurately.
And so there's a possibility that this test that can test your saliva as another bodily fluid that could be potentially measured, that would be just a lot easier and a better experience, certainly a less painful experience than having to prick your finger all the time.
So researchers at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, recently published in the journal Nanophotonics about the sensor that they created that actually successfully tested using artificial saliva what people's blood sugar levels may be. This actually was very helpful in helping them diagnose potential patients with diabetes, as it was easier to use than having to do the traditional finger prick method.
And so, I mean, I don't think this is ready for prime time yet, but I think it's good news in that there are people out there trying to work towards something that would be a lot less painful and easier, and hopefully, as we develop this further, would be accurate and easily available to people. I don't know if they gave a timeline for how soon that'll be.
Yeah, it's really interesting. This field of nanophotonics or nanochemistry is really taking off and may revolutionize what we need in terms of diagnosing patients at a more reasonable cost down the line. So I think it's interesting to kind of keep on the back of our mind.
Yeah, we need to follow that. Okay, let's talk about graphic cigarette label warnings.
Sounds very scary, but this has been something
that should be scary, right?
It should be.
If you're going to smoke something that will kill you.
Exactly. It's used as a deterrent in many countries, including Australia and Great Britain. Their labels have now been changed as opposed to saying that cigarettes could be harmful to your health in script, but to now show very graphic pictures of people with even things like holes in their neck because of this complications that they've had from smoking.
And they looked at people in the United States and Australia and some different countries and found that the tiny little warning labels on the cigarette packs in the United States were something that made smokers think about the health risks. And the people who did notice it on a regular basis were more likely to be interested in quitting. But then compared with the people in Australia who had these giant, larger graphic labels, they were much more likely to notice it and more likely to be wanting or at least trying to quit.
And with more and more the importance of smoking cessation taking limelight in countries like the United States and the importance of learning more about the harmful effects of smoking, it is an interesting discussion to have as to whether or not we will shift to labels like that down the line.
Yeah, we certainly should. But, you know, we should get our health sciences librarians to post some of those graphic labels on our blog and see. I don't know how scary they are.
Yeah,
but
your discretion
yes,
advised.
Yes, exactly. All right. So we've had a chance to talk about a possible, you know, like a future saliva test to replace, eventually, I hope, needle pricking for people with diabetes.
About graphics. Cigarette labels and how they deter people from smoking.
About the surprising finding that widowhood might delay dementia in some seniors.
And about the importance of you and your physician both learning how to adequately write prescriptions for children.
That concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Sarah Rosenquist and Dr. Stephen Shaben about sex, therapy, and marriage. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Amir Barzin. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Amir Barzan. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with Dr. Sarah Rosenquist, psychotherapist and author, as well as Dr. Stephen Shaben, urologist, Associated Urologist of North Carolina, about sex, therapy, and marriage.
Welcome, Dr. Rosenquist and Dr. Shaben. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I wonder if we might start by way of introduction to our listeners to tell us, really, how did your careers develop and what exactly is it that you do?
Okay. Well, I am a clinical psychologist, broadly speaking. I'm a health psychologist in particular. That's my board specialty. And I do reproductive and sexual health in particular, kind of as a niche specialty. It's not all I see, but it's what I like the most.
Mm-hmm. And you, Dr. Shaben?
I am a reproductive urologist, which just means that I spent an extra year of training after my residency in reproductive medicine and surgery for the male. And there's only a few programs in the country, and I was fortunate enough to get into one of them.
And so you both see a variety of patients, but what is sort of a typical type of patient, or what do you see the most of in your waiting room?
Well, the kinds of patients that I see where I overlap more with Dr. Shaben and also with another physician, gynecologist, Dr. Clark, are the sexual medicine patients. And those might be men with erectile difficulties, ejaculatory difficulties, may have a history of cancer and be overcoming that. 60% of cancer patients will have sexual difficulties. 67% of cardiac patients will have sexual difficulties.
Wow.
There's a whole lot of overlap there, which is actually how I got into this particular specialty as a health psychologist. Roughly, you know, 70% plus or minus of any medical population is going to have some sexual difficulties. And it turns out that I'm pretty easy to talk about sex with, apparently. I use the patient's language, and sometimes it's raw. And they kind of get it right away that, oh, I can let my hair down and really
talk about things.
Talk about what's real.
Yeah.
And for the women, I'll often see people who have women who have low desire or painful intercourse. That may or may not have to do with a medical issue. Anorgasmia, seeing a lot of that nowadays in younger women.
And you refer patients to her, so a lot of your patients, you must discover, have sexual problems.
Absolutely. Our patients go back and forth. Sarah sees men and women. I see men and women, but I don't see women for sexual dysfunction. I primarily only take care of men with sexual dysfunction. And our friend who is not present today, who is a gynecologist, would do the female sexual dysfunction. But for the male sexual dysfunction, my forte is actually infertility. So about 20% of those males have sexual dysfunction. And then about 30-40% of the other portion of my practice is men who primarily come in with sexual dysfunction, not infertility.
And so I may have a different take on it as a family doctor following people over time. Mm-hmm. And for me, I mean, my patients and I talk about sex a lot, and I really believe that one's sexual health is like a big, very important piece of one's overall health.
Yeah.
And that we need to be talking about it, and that we need to be working through these issues, and it requires a lot of follow-up and a lot of things. And don't you worry, I'll be sending some patients your way. But you know, I wonder what we know in the literature about that. Do you have any reflection on, you know, that belief of that sexual health is just a very important part of one's overall well-being? Okay. It's got to be true.
It's got to be true. I think it is true. I wrote a fact sheet for the APA. It hasn't been published yet, but it's kind of in the pipeline, where I went through all of the medical diagnoses and the percentage of folks that have the sexual difficulties. And what I'm seeing in my practice is that oftentimes they been to their physician and they didn't feel comfortable bringing it up. Many of them have a psychologist or a psychotherapist that they're seeing, and they intuitively get it that they really couldn't talk about sex with that particular therapist. And they'll tell me, oh, I brought it up, and I could see them squirming in their seat, and I just dropped it.
Mm. Well, it does take a lot of time and commitment and follow-up to do it well.
I think so. But it also, at least to be board certified, it takes a lot of training. And a whole lot of people think that they can talk about sex, but they're, A, not comfortable doing it per the other person that's talking to them.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
And B, there's a really lot of information to know. It's truly a place where it crosses over into medicine very quickly, and one has to be alert to that.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that we all feel as practitioners is that confine of that patient room, or where that patients get a chance to open up to us, is a unique situation. But it is one where I think that there are situations where patients don't feel as comfortable talking about these situations. Mm-hmm. And as a urologist, I'm sure you see many men that come in that have a simple complaint. We all see it. You know, they come in, medication refill or question for a doctor, and then you get this whole new situation that presents. How do you interact with that?
Sometimes it's on the way out the door.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, you've already thought you've handled it, and they're like, oh, and by the way, I have this problem.
You know, I think the problem, you know, it's a disorder. It's an issue. Is it a medical illness? You know, it's all controversial, but I think it's fairly rampant. I think that it's untouched. I was just in for my yearly physical this morning, and you fill out that intake sheet, right?
Right.
There's one question on there. There's a million things on there, and there's only one about, you know, do you feel safe in your relationship, and are there any sexual difficulties? That's it. And we're low on mental health as well, and we know that's pretty rampant. Viagra is out of the closet, and people will talk a little bit more now about erectile dysfunction, but all the other things are not discussed. And in particular, like premature ejaculation, it's rampant, and we don't have a treatment for it. And I refer to Dr. Sarah often.
And can you help people with that?
I do.
Wonderful. Okay, we're just getting started. We're talking about sex today, y'all. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we will continue talking with our guests, Dr. Sarah Rosenquist, psychotherapist and author, as well as Dr. Stephen Shaben, urologist, about sex, therapy, and marriage. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Amir Barzan. Stay with us. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Amir Barzan. We've been talking with Dr. Sarah Rosenquist, psychotherapist and author, as well as Dr. Stephen Shaben, urologist at Associated Urologists of North Carolina, about sex, therapy, and marriage. And before the break, Dr. Rosenquist, you mentioned that you do a lot of work with patients who may have low libido or problems with interest and desire. And I mean, one of the things I'd be interested in your reflection, one of the things I often reflect on is in a lot of our cultural aspects, there's a lot of this me, I don't want to, I didn't feel like it, I was tired, you know, I wasn't in the mood. And what I know you've done a lot of work around this as an expert in the field, mm-hmm. around desire and like how to get there and bridges to that. Share with us some of these elements that you've discovered.
Well, I don't know that I've discovered them by myself. They're in the literature. But in terms of bridges to desire, you've got the visual pathway. You've got the emotional connection, which is huge. You've got the sensate focus, and that's where you pay attention to your body, and you've got to be into your body. And finally, erotic imagination. And like a car, a four-cylinder car that's kicking on all four cylinders, things are going to work better when you've got all pathways open. So that's one of the things that I'll assess. That's something I educate people about. A lot of times in long-term relationships, people get into habits and they get used to, one of the things that I see frequently is that they'll get into a rut where that look, or if he's touching me that way, this is what it means. Particularly women are likely to do an algorithm in their head and spin out. Just how tired, how long is it going to take now?
Right.
How tired am I going to be afterwards? So there are benefits to planning, being methodical. You do it when you're dating, after all.
Right.
You know? I mean, you get the new dress, you know, pedicure, whatever. And you're thinking, wow, you think he'll kiss me this night, you know? A little bit of ambiguity is nice. A little bit of seduction is nice. A little bit of planfulness is sometimes nice.
And how important, this is a loaded question, of course, but the role of communication in couples. Like, when you're counseling, I imagine there are times when you're counseling both partners and sometimes when you're counseling just an individual. Uh-huh. But how do you advise couples to communicate with one another about what they need or what things make them more interested and what things really don't?
Well, I've got several exercises, kind of stepped up homework exercises that I give people, and they serve partly as an intervention but also partly as diagnostic information for me so that I can get at that. Communication doesn't always have to be in words. Mm-hmm. And learning to attune to your partner, sometimes not with words, is really important. We found that more in previous generations, so the older folks are more likely to intuit one another rather than use words. Younger mm-hmm. folks tend to be more comfortable with words, mm-hmm. in my experience.
And Dr. Shaben, I think that one of the issues that we come across here is that you see patients who come and talk to you about their issues that they may have. And I think that in many situations, people come to the doctor to say, here's my problem and let's fix it. How is it for you to address a situation like that? And how does Sarah help tie in that bridge so that you can work together to come to a common goal?
I mean, primarily when I see a gentleman of any age, and surprisingly we see more younger age group, after age 30 it seems to kick in. And I think that men have a problem with aging sexually. They expect at 35 and 55 to be as intuitive and rigid as they were when they were 19. Mm. And it's just not going to be that way. And so you have to get them to understand that they're aging. And I have a lot of healthy nutrition talks, and you need to lose weight talks, and you need to get off your butt and exercise talks. You're allowed to have sex without reaching climax every time talks, because they put undue pressure on themselves. And men suffer with a lot of performance anxiety. So whether they have real vascular, as an origin of vascular disease, blood flow problems is the primary cause of erectile dysfunction. So whether they really have a lot of that or not, they all suffer with performance anxiety. And so whether you can help them with their erectile dysfunction or not, they often have some overlying psychological issues. And that's where Dr. Sarah comes in, so I can get them over to her to help with that. And or if they suffer from just premature ejaculation, as I tell them, there's no pill. And you can look online, you can read the chapter in a book at Barnes & Noble, or you can see a therapist, and it's 90% plus curable. Mm-hmm. But that means
wow.
you have to meet another face, and you have to, you know, kick open your insurance card again. And sometimes it's hard for them to want to do it that badly. So unless they're getting beat up at home and pushed into my office, sometimes they just want to take the pill mm-hmm. and leave.
Yeah, like a quick fix.
Exactly.
I mean, just
but
take
I mean,
them
of course, you know, I do the routine stuff to make sure that there's nothing seriously wrong with them. But most people don't have a serious problem. And I'll tell you, more than half my patients are under age 55.
That's amazing to me to think about, is that I think that, like you had mentioned before about discussing all of this, is that there's almost this boundary where people are afraid to talk about these issues with sexuality, and it happening at such a younger age than what we assume, I think, is eye-opening to a lot of people to say, well, this is normal. Why can I not have this conversation with my doctor? I've had a patient who I just said those exact words to me the other day and said, is this normal for me at the age of 50, a very physically fit male to not be able to perform like I did when I was 20. And just hearing a physician say, yes, this is normal, this is part of the cycle, was enough for him to walk home and say, I feel pretty good about myself.
Right, exactly. And some people are pressuring themselves with trying to have sex too frequently when they're trying to conceive. The wife thinks you're supposed to have sex every day. And the husband comes home and he's tired and he has a bad day. Oh, crap, what a week for her to be ovulating. I just don't feel like it.
Right.
So he has situational erectile dysfunction, and that's where the pills come in. Mm-hmm. We help him get by. But those pills, for the most part, in somebody who isn't that ill with sexual dysfunction, ooh, they like that. They like that extra rigidity, and then they become psychologically, I think, somewhat dependent on it.
Okay.
Now
yeah,
they feel yeah, the they next do. Time, well, not under any pressure, but geez, I really hope things work out. So, the pill's in the, let's go get another one.
Uh-huh.
And then they're in your office in a couple months and they would like more. And you're thinking, gee, you're only 38. You don't really need to be doing this. Why, you need to take a chill pill, or maybe you've got some psychological things going on in that relationship. Again, Dr. Sarah comes in. And I tell them up front, I'm not a counselor, but I can get you, you know, good counseling. And again, I say, you're worth it. And so whether you have insurance coverage or not, spend a couple $100 on yourself. You're worth it.
Well, and also, your marriage is worth it.
Hold the whole relationship, of course.
Yeah. And I wonder, you know, what is your experience, Dr. Sarah, with the value of intimacy in a marriage and in a healthy going forward marriage, some level of intimacy and communication? I mean,
yeah, they do. And when you're having sex enough, whatever that is for a particular
you.
Couple, right? It's only 15% of marital happiness. This doesn't seem like it's a big deal. But when it's going wrong or it's not happening, it's 75% of marital unhappiness.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's huge. And oftentimes, you can't, you know, I don't know that there's any clear causal link or research that proves a causal link.
Mm-hmm.
In psychology, the catchphrase is all behavior is overdetermined. So, you know, we live in a culture that likes to think in terms of one cause, one effect.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, you get a lot of things in the soup and something precipitates out. And that something that precipitates out may be a physical dysfunction or disease or whatever that they go to see a physician for. But part of the soup is going to be the quality of that marriage and whether or not sex is happening enough, whether or not it feels safe and comfortable and it's
it
getting
matters.
And in, it, you know, when sex is happening and people are having orgasms together, it's part of the neurochemistry of attachment, and you bathe the brains and all in all of these. In this, so.
And what about for people in a marriage where one person really cannot have sex? They've come to you, you've offered them options, the pills, and you can maybe mention some of the other options. But then coming back to you, Dr. Sarov, when one of them really can't, what do you advise people for intimacy?
Well, we call that involuntary celibacy. And the absence of penis and vagina intercourse doesn't necessarily mean you're not having sex.
Good point.
I don't think anybody believed it when he said, I haven't had sex with that woman, or oral sex didn't count.
I had an older couple teach me about the term outer course.
Interesting.
Uh-huh.
So because she was somewhat fragile and ill and tender, and he and her still wanted to be physically intimate, so they told me about how they do outer course. I mean, so you can have sex without having penile vaginal penetration.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, but people think that perhaps that's not the real thing, because the typical older guy feels if he doesn't have penetration, then he hasn't had real sex, right?
And so some of that may be in your counseling, reframing and sort of celebrating that intimacy and being creative for other ways of being close with one another.
I like to tell folks that my goal is for them to have a lot of touch and affection and some of it to be sensual and sexual and naked and some proportion of that to be intercourse maybe, climax maybe. But all of the touch and the sensuality and the ways in which they're together emotionally and physically, it needs to be much larger than the domain.
Than just the act of that one
thing.
Than
just genital contact.
Because as you age, I have to teach so many men as they age about how their body's going to change sexually, and it's simply as follows. It's going to take longer to get it's going to take more time to get a good erection. It may take more energy and effort to keep the erection. It will take longer perhaps to get to climax, depending on your excitement level. Climax may not be as good and the same every time, and or you may not need to reach climax every time, and you've got to let that go. And it's hard for them because they keep thinking about the way they want it to be. And it's not the way maybe it's going to be with that person at this stage in your life. But it can still be good.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's all good.
These are important messages. And we're just sort of getting started. I've got so many things I want to talk about. But we do need to wrap up. We're going to have you guys back. This is great. A beginning of a conversation about sex and therapy and marriage. For our listeners who want more information, I'm sure there are people out there who might want some new thoughts and new perspectives and know where to go for information about sex. Where do you refer people? Do you have websites?
I have a lot of websites and links on my website, drsarah.com, D-R-S-A-R-A, no H, .com.
Great.
And they can always get some of that similar stuff from our website, is A-U-N-C, urology.com.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, Dr. Chabon and Dr. Rosenquist, for being with us today and for giving us the beginning of a lively conversation.
Absolutely. We've had a great talking with Dr. Sarah Rosenquist, psychotherapist and author, as well as Dr. Stephen Chabon, urologist at Associated Urologists of North Carolina, about sex therapy and marriage. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Amir Barzan.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu.
Let's have Erica Lloyd, our executive producer, give us our House Calls for today. Erica?
I'm 32, healthy, though slightly overweight, but working on it. My dear friend needs a kidney, and I have the blood type that makes me a universal donor. I'm seriously considering donating her my kidney since her previous ones have failed and she's back on dialysis. I want to do the right thing, and I also need to consider my husband and children and future risk that it could bring to me. What should I do?
Wow, this is such a important conversation to have, and one that's actually very near and dear to me. I had a very close friend just go through this exact situation where he did go through the entire process, and he was a perfect blood and tissue match for a friend that he donated a kidney to. And he's not even 30 years old yet and went through this process and was very happy to do it and was at home the next and within 3 days and back with his wife. And they had the same discussion about what the effects would be on their marriage and their future children.
And I think it is important that you are, though you're being very selfless and considering giving a kidney, which is a beautiful thing, to be sure to consider the feelings and needs of your husband and your children and making sure that this is, you know, a family decision and one that everybody feels okay about. It is your kidney, but you point out some good things about, you know, the what ifs that are pretty remote, but something to consider. Thinking about your family history, if there's any history in your family of kidney disease or kidney problems, your own risk for developing kidney problems in the future, being checked for diabetes, since you said you are overweight, your blood pressure, your own like kidney function now, those types of things. But it is something that people can do safely and go carry on to have normal lives. And so those are things to discuss with your doctor from your perspective as you weigh out those things. And then, you know, as you move forward in the process, it may be that you're not at the right match and that something else comes along. Lots of challenges in that process, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. But again, what a wonderful act, and I'm sure your friend is very appreciative to have you around.
Mm-hmm. Let us know what you decide and how it goes. Let's have our next house call question.
My friend, who is in her 20s, had 4 beers at a party and then started having seizures. Can alcohol cause seizures like that?
Well, possibly, but that would be really unusual in a person who, I mean, if a person already has a seizure disorder, so maybe, I don't know how well you know this friend, but if she already has problems with having seizures, then drinking alcohol, sure, that can lower your seizure threshold. Certain medications can, we call it the seizure threshold, so the threshold for your body where you might have a seizure. Or if you're drinking a lot, maybe you don't take your seizure medicines, which then could also lower that seizure threshold that you could have a seizure. So I think there might be other parts to the story here.
Yeah. And in theory, when we think of situations with alcohol and seizures, it's usually withdrawal seizures. So when people are not drinking after a few days, that's when we normally see issues with seizures and alcohol use. But just like Christy had mentioned, there might be more to the story than just the alcohol consumption.
Yeah, I do think you should be cautious with your drinking and look out for your friends in this way. And often, if you are being a responsible adult, then you're able to then help people when things come up.
Yeah, always make sure that you're taking care of those around you and also taking care of yourself.
Mm-hmm. Good advice, Amir.
Is it normal for someone in hospice care to have fits of energy after having been sleeping for several weeks? This happened to my grandmother, who was 95.
Is it normal? Well, wow, congratulations to your grandmother for being 95 and for having fits of energy. That sounds, it sounds like, depending on how you frame it, the fits of energy sound like probably a good thing. Sometimes because of whatever body processes that are going on in her body at that time and that age, she may be more sleepy. It's very easy to get infections or other things that can make you tired and more groggy. But it's a beautiful thing that she sort of woke up and wanted to have more energy. Sometimes that does happen like right before people pass away. Mm-hmm. But in this instance, it sounds like it happened and things are going okay.
Yeah. And that was one thing that I wanted to mention is that there are very frequently times, and we're not really sure why, where people have episodes of clarity or increased energy when they're in these terminal illnesses before they pass or just at a random moment. And we don't really understand why that happens. But one of the things, just like Christy had mentioned, is that when we are in terminal times, something as simple kind of bring us down for a little bit. So she may have been overcoming, gave her the increased energy, or she may have just been sleeping a little bit more and she woke up and felt like everything was going great.
Yeah, when I'm 95, I want to take long naps and tell everyone, let me sleep.
That's right.
But we certainly hope that this level of energy continues for your grandmother. Thank you for sharing. Let's take our last house call question.
I have pain in my calves when I walk upstairs. My doctor called this claudication. What can I do to make this better?
Okay, well, we'll have to do this quickly. So claudication is the word that we use where people have, just like what you have, where your calves hurt, especially when you walk upstairs. And that has to do with the blood flow not working well to sort of get that oxygen return and get to the muscles in your calves.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we recommend quite frequently outside of medications is for people to do an exercise program to help with claudication.
There are some medicines that might be beneficial, and there are other things to think about for your body that if you have claudication then and some sort of problems with your blood flow in your legs, you could have problems with your blood flow other places. So stopping smoking if you smoke and getting control over your blood pressure and doing some of those things would be wise. So you want to sort of partner with your overall health with your doctor to think through how to make this better and also how to then reduce your risk of other blood flow problems in your body.
Of course. Those are the most important parts of taking care of yourself.
All right. Thank you guys for joining us today for your health. We hope it was fun for you and that you addressed some issues and concerns that are important to your health. We want you to share your questions, share your stories, email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Follow us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes. Get our health app at the App Store by searching Your Health, one word, for a free download.
And we'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine and UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship and our guests today, Dr. Sarah Rosenquist and Dr. Stephen Shaben. We hope you'll enjoy join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Amir Barzin.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.